Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. Under lockdown and with ever-increasing back pain, I am John Iderola, a shell of a man. Welcome to my home. How's it going?
Oh my god. That was the world. I'm in the same boat, dude. There, in the back of this shot, if you go wide enough, and I didn't even straighten it up today, they had. I have this chair that I went and got from the office, and I like found ways to contort myself and my belongings so that they could fit. They could accommodate this guy. Got it home. I'm like, I love it. It's the one that you can roll back on.
Yeah.
Instantly, my back starts seizing up.
Yeah. Yeah, the ever increasing pain, maybe other people under lockdown are experiencing that, but two, so there are people who just do this, or, you know, a more professional version of this from home, and that's just what they do. That's what they've always done. And there are people who are, in terms of their constitution, are able to do that. I am an extreme introvert, but I need at least as much contact as the studio provides. My brain is falling apart.
No, John. Anyway. You're an introvert. No, you're an ambivert. You're the theory of the universe where it like condenses in the big crunch, big bang, big crunch, big bang. That's you because you are the one who facilitates all the social interactions. Like, hey guys, let's have some game night. And I'm like, oh, I just want to crawl under my bed and go to sleep. But I think we both are those kinds of introverts where it's like, but I need to tell people need to be subjected to these opinions.
Exactly.
No, I don't want to touch or see anyone. But John, how long do you think this, do you know what day of the quarantine we are under as TYT employees?
Feels like 105.
103. That was amazing.
My God, I'm well calibrated.
John just won the Corvette because he guessed how many jelly beans were in the jar.
Exactly, yeah. You know, we could go on for another 105 days. And might have to. Ask,
I asked Alexa, how long has it been since March 20th? And she was, and I was like, please don't tell me. Please don't tell me. Please don't tell me. 120 days.
Oh my God.
And I'm watching the show Alone on Hulu, where people just go into the wilderness for as long as possible until they call someone to come pick them up in a speedboat and take them away from Patagonia.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. And I know they're in the forests and the Altiplano or wherever, but they're in the mountains. And then they just go, it's been crazy because it's been 51 days. And I'm like,
yeah. Yeah.
I know they're wildly different, just amount of time.
Yeah. I was in the Arctic for two different month-long periods. And, like, I was seeing people. Like, I have not interacted with a person other than my wife in 103 days. Like, I know you're like, oh, no, you're joking. Well, yes, okay, so there's the main housewoman who we live with. I haven't cheated once.
You like, gotta stop
have a friend over.
People can interpret multiple ways.
Okay.
I've only seen my wife.
Wife,
next
baby,
breath.
I swear. No.
I haven't cheated. It's like.
Yeah. No, I'm being honest. I haven't, like, you know, like, I know it's sort of dangerous, but let's just meet up. I haven't done that once.
But you've invited me over.
I know.
And
you
I
won't
no.
come. I didn't say I haven't tried. I haven't done it. Anyway. Okay. So our producers are probably losing their minds. In a different way than I am. Theirs is more rage, mine is more depression. So let's try to make them a little bit reassured. We're going to try to fit in a ton of content, okay? Because there's a lot of news out there. And more importantly, we have a 3-day weekend coming up. So here's what we're going to try to do. we're going to burn through a ton of news, okay? Starting off with, actually, before we get to the breaking news, can I just mention, by the way, because I just saw this right before we went live, a whole bunch of Riot equipment, like, clad police are clearing the chop in Seattle.
Yeah, that's
true. They're just,
true.
Like, moving through. They're like, nope, that's done. And honestly, my reaction to that is I would have expected they would have done that much earlier. I am honestly shocked that they didn't lose it on those people earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Capitol Hill, man. Mm-hmm. It's just like, if something weird's going to happen in Seattle, it's going to happen in Capitol Hill. And I think that is the reason that it's been going on for so long. Is they're like, yeah, it's always like a free expression zone around there. So now they're like, let's sweep it out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't been keeping up with that aspect of it for like a couple weeks. So I don't know how it's escalated or not, but I'm certain that if you read any article about it, it says, here are the three things that have happened there all in a row. So it sounds like it's a nightmare, but yeah. I do remind people that at the height of it all, when everyone was talking on Fox News about how terrible things were in the chop, the photos I was seeing were outdoor picnics and screenings of documentaries in the intersection. So
that sounds great. And yeah, I remember Fox News had found a picture of a guy wearing like kind of tactical gear and like I think maybe like a green cloth mask, and they began photoshopping him into other images. How are you allowed to do that? You can't
because
do that.
It's just a thumbnail. It's just a thumbnail. No, it's not. It's not because but it's Capitol Hill, so it's like it's not quite like Folsom, but it's just like this man is clad in all leather. And he's got a handlebar mustache. He's intimidating. Yeah. He's a leather dad.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you normally like Fox News. You normally like when people dress in like faux Call of Duty gear. Why is this one, guys? Is it because of the handlebar mustache? Oh, okay, actually, I kind of get it. But yeah, like to Photoshop. Okay, so which is it? On YouTube, are we like, you know, are we just a bunch of idiots you don't have to respect, and but also can get away with things like photoshopping interesting thumbnails? You're just presenting it as an image on a news website. That's crazy. And anyway, look, you're totally right. There were a couple of instances of violence. Who knows? Is it representative of other things going on? Is it people who've infiltrated? I mean, so much of the violence that we've seen ends up being right-wingers in other parts of the country. I honestly have no idea. But again, it seemed like the perfect storm for them to crack down on it. And again, I'm sort of surprised that it didn't happen earlier. And we'll see how effective it is. I mean, they're moving through. There's an executive order from the mayor. Supposedly, this is the end. We'll see if that actually happens. But the video I've seen so far, that they're clearing people out. And it's getting back towards that brutality that we saw earlier.
Oi.
Oi, indeed. Okay, moving on. Lots of news. Let's jump to it. This morning, breaking news, Fox firing Ed Henry. We actually learned about it from his co-host.
A moment now for some news about the co-anchor of this program, Ed Henry. After a recent claim and investigation involving sexual misconduct in the workplace, Ed has been terminated from Fox News. In an internal memo to employees, Fox News Media CEO Suzanne Scott and President and Executive Editor Jay Wallace addressed this very serious issue in an effort to bring full transparency to it and emphasize that we will continue to strive to maintain a safe and inclusive workplace for all employees. Rotating anchors will be sitting in with me until a replacement is named.
Okay, and we left in that like pause because she seemed to be affected by it.
Yeah, and it may take some time to find a male host on Fox News who isn't implicated in some kind of weird, pervy sexual assault claim.
I know that when the breaking news came out, and I could already see in the comments, by the way, people were like, is it Hannity? Is it all this stuff? No, it was Ed Henry, who's, you know, ostensibly one of their, like, straight news people or whatever. In terms of the details, what we do know is Suzanne Scott and Jay Wallace, the media CEO and president, put out a statement saying, on Thursday, June 25th, we received a complaint about Ed Henry from a former employee's attorney involving willful sexual misconduct in the workplace years ago. Based on investigative findings, Ed has been terminated. There's not much information there, but the information that is interesting is that complaint was 6 days ago.
Wait, seems but it like, said years, a complaint based on activities from
six... Yes, the activity
six...
had been years ago. The complaint was just 6 years ago.
That's well, a six fairly days fast ago, you ter- said.
6 days ago, yeah. The complaint.
You said years.
Not the incident. Oh, sorry. Anyway, it's a very fast turnaround for the investigation that they actually did this. And so we don't know what the actual complaint was about. It seems likely that we may never know, but they fired him fast.
Yeah, they really did. That is so weird. I mean, he also has had, it's strange that he had, he took 4 months off in, I do have it up here, in 2017, after having an extramarital affair with a Vegas cocktail waitress, and then he came back and he was reassigned to just general reporting and he couldn't do politics anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I don't know the full details of that and whether it was a consensual affair, but they say that there were charged text messages between the two. So I wonder if they just looked at it and were like, you know what?
Yeah.
This seems moderately credible. We got to get rid of Ed Henry. But it's just one of those things that, I don't know. I assume that all the things that they do at Fox News and all the terrible messaging and all the racially charged crap that they cover in their primetime lineup, they then have this weird coefficient of firing, whether they do get rid of you or not. And whether you stick around is based on how many people care if you leave. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody really cares if Ed Henry goes. He's not with Fox and Friends. He's not with Hannity. He's not Tucker Carlson. No one cares. He's one of the interchangeable kind of like doughy faces that they throw in there because they used all of their strong features on Bret Baier and all that was left was like circles. So okay. It's like okay. Him and the pollster guy.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the pollster guy. Okay, so I have a little bit of thought on that. Let me just fill in for people who might not be familiar with Ed Henry. He's a longtime Washington, D.C. correspondent, joined Fox News 9 years ago after 7 years at CNN. He served as chief White House correspondent for Fox during the Obama administration before a stint as co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. So he was previously with Fox and Friends. In December, he was promoted to co-anchor of America's Newsroom. And I'm going to be completely honest with you. I don't know much about him because I don't try to watch Fox much. But he has been described as sort of like their up-and-coming, you know, serious news person who hypothetically someday might be important for the network in its non-opinion capacity. And the question is, how important is their non-opinion capacity to them? And I am just fairly certain that the standards for firing have got to be different. I mean, maybe the times have changed. Maybe that's all it is. And they say in that statement, we overhauled our HR. We take this far more seriously. We don't want any more movies made about us and all that. Maybe that's what it is. But when I think back to the stuff around Roger Ailes, the stuff around Bill O'Reilly, it wasn't a 6-day turnaround. So either the culture has massively changed, which I find hard to believe, or it has something to do with, as you pointed out, the sort of relative power and value you bring to the network.
Yeah. And I think when I think of Ed Henry, I think occasionally he gets caught too transparently echoing Trump stuff, but that's only the kind of links that make their way to Mediaite so I can laugh at them. But I think within Fox News, he really fits that mold of their octogenarian, septuagenarian base watching them, seeing a blue-eyed, floppy-haired white kid and going, he's a nice boy.
Yeah.
And they can no longer say that in the wake of all the sexual assault claims.
Yeah. So, before we
and
jump
just
in...
Really, when you say willful sexual misconduct, some people were like, oh, did the other person like it? No, willful means he was willfully flouting the laws.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, not consensual. Exactly.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR,
The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I want to get your quick opinion on this. So Artana says, thoughts on Wizards of the Coast folding under pressure of calls for orc sensitivity training. So Artana is referring to the fact that, and I'm sure you have not seen this, Brett, Wizards of the Coast, they make Dungeons and Dragons. And so they are revising some of the racial descriptions of things like the dark elves, the orcs. Oh, you are familiar with this story.
I had Fiend Folio as a kid. I had no idea what it was. My cousin was really into Dungeons and Dragons,
but I
wasn't like old enough to really appreciate it, so I flipped through and I was like, oh, okay, these are scary. But that I know, like, I read the descriptions of characters as a kid.
Yeah. And look, so there are orcs, like these non-humans or whatever, are described generally, even up to the newest edition of Dungeons and Dragons, which is much better in terms of gender and sexuality and things like that, as sort of born inherently evil. They just are evil. And the culture is barbaric, and that reinforces it even more. So they're saying, effectively, they don't want to, going forward, describe some races, which in D&D means species. They're not races. They're non-human species. Dwarves, elves, halflings, things like that.
Which itself is really troubling.
It is. Fantasy, for a very long time, has had racial problems like that, as not being inherently evil going forward, which is a pretty big change for the game, and we'll see how it goes. I know that there has been some pushback against that, but a lot of people do like it, and D&D and other RPGs have become far more accessible with, you know, sorts of people who had not necessarily felt welcomed by those games for a very long time have been, you know, flocking to it in droves over the past few years, and I think that this is another good step forward.
Yes. Just my really quick take on that is, if you're upset that they're changing like the fundamental like tropes, which have analogs to reality, like those things were written for those reasons in the first place. Like the reason that it was written to symbolize an evil race is because the people making it thought that certain races were evil.
Yes.
And you can still have as developed and interesting a canon by focusing on other ways to portray things that are actually happening in the world. And those are way more interesting and way more developed than just saying, like, I want to be the evil people.
Mm-hmm. I want to kill the evil people.
Star Trek does a better job of that. What if a group became obsessed with war and all they thought about was war? What if a planet became obsessed with logic and all they did was act logically?
Yeah.
Like, it's more fundamentally based on ethos and morals and value systems or whatever
That is true. But Star Trek has had a problem with this for a long time. Like, there are sort of vaguely anti-Semitic aliens and vaguely non-white. It's not entirely clear exactly which direction they're going, but that are spoken about in sort of quasi-racist terms, which for this, like, elevated advanced civilization is probably not how they should be doing it. But anyway,
I realize I'm just thinking about Eric Bana in that one movie. It's like, oh, they seem pretty obsessed with war.
Yeah, that's
true. I liked it.
This morning, one of my producers sent me an Instagram post by Representative Rashida Tlaib that made me quite happy, both for the post, but also for the legislative effort that she is pushing forward. Here's the post from Rashida Tlaib saying, "You can't wipe the smile off my face because of all of you. This was possible. I am going to get enough votes to pass an amendment that will get $22.5 billion in infrastructure dollars to replace lead-infested pipes. We all deserve clean water." And what she's referring to there is an amendment that she was able to successfully put forward for the Moving Forward Act, a $1.5 trillion infrastructure bill that is obviously very large in terms of money. It's got $300 billion for repair of existing infrastructure, $100 billion for public transit, $100 billion for affordable housing infrastructure, another $100 billion for broadband, another $100 billion for high-poverty schools, and $70 billion for upgrades to the electricity grid. And so she is going to have some of that money be tapped specifically for taking out lead pipes, which is obviously very long overdue, and I think it's great that she got that added in. Probably, arguably, should have been in there in the first place, but she cares deeply about these issues, and so I'm glad that she's had this effect on the legislation.
It's so crazy that it has taken this long to get something in that won't pass.
You mean because, like, the entire bill seems unlikely to pass?
Yeah, the entire it takes this long to get something like this in a federal spending bill, especially when you consider that, like, lead pipes have been known. Lead is a neurotoxin. We've known that for a very long time, and it's still a problem. And it takes this long for something like this even to happen.
Yeah, 100%. And honestly, the Trump administration says that they're not going to do it. They say because it eliminates environmental reviews. I don't even know if that's in there. Let's say arguably it is. Doubt they care because they've stripped any number of different environmental reviews from different projects that they push forward. So that's just an obvious dodge. They're against a green infrastructure bill by pretending that that it's not environmentally sound enough. I doubt it. But anyway, we still want them, even if they can't pass it, to try to do the right thing. But I want to give you information going forward, because eventually maybe something like this could pass potentially under a different president. In terms of the total cost that it will take to get rid of lead contamination, in 2000, a cabinet-level task force suggested that all lead paint specifically could be eliminated by spending $17 billion per year for 10 years. So it is a very large amount of money for lead paint. That would be even more in today's dollars. We're talking about like a quarter of $1 trillion. We have all lead pipes would cost between a few billion to 50 billion. Obviously, the estimates there are broad. And you also have, for contaminated soil, potentially $100 billion would be needed to eliminate the worst contaminations based on some researchers. So this $22.5 billion would not do all of it, but it could potentially take care of the vast majority of lead pipes specifically. And as we said in the beginning, way overdue. Like, we know what the issue is. It's the lead pipes. We know what the solution is. It's replacing them. You just need to put the money into doing it. And in doing, create jobs around the country to do this replacing work for probably a few years. The fact that we don't do that, when we know that every day that those pipes continue in operation, they're potentially doing brain damage as well as other harm to Americans, especially children, because it's most detrimental in terms of their brain development, is just madness. That this should be, right. This bill should definitely pass. It shouldn't even have to be added as an amendment. It should be a bill by itself. Why wouldn't the Republicans in election year want to do this, knowing that in some of the states they desperately need to win in this election are the worst hit by this sort of lead contamination?
Yeah, but the people in the areas that have the lead pipes are not going to vote for Republicans in a billion years. And
it's worth a try.
And the representatives who would get credit for putting it forward are Democrats. So why would you give them a win? You need to tell. And that's why it's more incumbent upon us to reveal the ridiculous reasons why folks who are elected aren't doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And challenge them. Hey, do you want to win those? Take ownership of it. Take ownership of it and go harder.
Yeah.
They're never going to do that.
Well, and by the way, you know, obviously credit to Rashida Tlaib, but she also, this is an area of policy that she has been worried about. Back earlier, like about 2 months ago in the pandemic, She had legislation to stop water shutoffs during the pandemic. The idea of shutting off someone's water when they literally can't leave their house seems crazy, but it required legislation to try to stop. And so thankfully we have some people like Rashida Tlaib watching out for people, especially during these particularly dark times.
Yes, we do.
On the program recently, we tried to give credit to all of the Republicans, elected and media, who are pushing for people now to wear masks and to not feel that there's any stigma. Thank you to Mitch McConnell for your comments, and Kevin McCarthy and Sean Hannity and Steve Ducey and all of that. Unfortunately, some other prominent right wingers are still pushing misinformation and fear-mongering and trying to make a big partisan thing out of mask wearing. So I want to give you an idea of, as we continue this campaign, what are we up against? Well, we're up against things like this. Bill Mitchell, famous for really liking Trump, that's literally why he has hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers, tweeted, "I put on a mask and literally within seconds I am struggling to breathe."
Can we have a moment for Bill Mitchell's Twitter avatar?
Yeah.
Bill Mitchell, you know, some fancy people have like a leather stamped receptacle to put their keys in when they come in the door. Or some kind, a leather belt, like a fancy leather belt where you take like something and hit it and it makes an impression on the belt. He looks like one of those was struck by gamma radiation.
Okay. Anyway.
Came to life.
Brett, we're talking masks here. Now look, this is serious, because Bill Mitchell has lots of followers on Twitter who follow him for political analysis and stuff like that. And he says, within seconds, I'm struggling to breathe. Now, I don't think he has done this, but hypothetically, when he gets criticized for this tweet, he's going to say, back in May, I had some sort of blood clot in my lung or something like that. He apparently had some sort of thing like that. I don't know if that's true. Let's assume that it is. I don't think it would cause this. But here's the thing. Putting out that tweet tells all of his followers the right thing to do is to pretend that masks are incapacitating. And we've already seen tons of that at this point. It used to be that the Republican Party tried to, like, pretend that they're really strong, you know? And that's how you are patriotic and good and alpha. Now you're supposed to pretend that you are barely able to function. And that is how you show that you are a patriotic American.
He is flailing like a namby-pamby European soccer player.
You mean when they pretend to be injured?
Like, are you kidding me? There are so many videos going around right now of Karen saying they can't breathe. And there are a few other videos going around right now of, like, there's a young girl with a breathing problem who has her, like, oxygen reading gauge on her finger. She's like, I do have a breathing problem, and I have to take rescue inhalers and all this stuff. And here is my oximetry scale right now. And she puts on one mask and another mask and a third mask. And it stays the same. Yeah. This is just utter fiction. This is you being too wussy to wear a mask. You are being a little flailing, flopping soccer player.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have comments coming in from people who are like, I got asthma and I keep marching against racism in 90 degree weather with a mask on. So F people who bitch and whine about wearing masks. Yeah. And it's really... Like, he also, like, let's say hypothetically his medical thing stops him from wearing a mask. It probably doesn't, but let's say that it does. He was also tweeting saying he had a video that he posted of Dr. Fauci having a mask on and then taking it off. And he's like, why, if Dr. Fauci, after just seconds, has to lean against a desk because he can't breathe. No. People have been wearing these masks forever and not dying. Surgeons don't die after 30 seconds of wearing a mask. How tight are you putting this on? That's causing it. It's just not true. And the issue is that he has lots of influence, lots of clout. People believe, even as he's been spreading misinformation the entire time, back in March 21st, so a day into us being, you know, locked down at TYT, he tweeted, when COVID-19 reaches 51 million infected in the U.S. and kills 55,000, someone let me know. Today, flu season is almost over, and we're at 276 U.S. dead. amateur numbers. Okay, well, twice as many people have died. Is he taking it more seriously? No, I'd argue he's taking it far less serious than he was when he was denying that.
Maybe someone just didn't let him know. Like, that's actually my bad.
That's true.
I didn't let him know. My bad. So, Bill, Willie, the satchel boy who is hit by, I want to say, lightning now. Mm-hmm. You saddlebag idiot moron. 100,000 plus.
Yeah.
How many is it now? Like 120?
It's like 128, I think, now. Officially, again. Who knows what it actually is. And so the issue is, it isn't that it's killing people, because it's not. That's stupid. It's literally the stupidest thing ever. I don't even agree with you. I don't think it is actually that he's too, or that they are too wussy to do it. They could do it, and it is easy. It's that they have to pretend to be so weak that a cloth mask would kill them. And the reason is that Bill Mitchell is, above everything else, a right-wing grifter. And only career is getting people to pay attention to him. And so the thing they put out and ran with initially was wearing a mask is bending down to the tyranny of commie libs. So now Sean Hannity, potentially, he theoretically wants Trump to win. He cares about the deaths at least a little bit. He can potentially move on the mask thing. But Bill Mitchell is just a grifter.
Mm-hmm.
And so how is he supposed to now say, you know what, turns out they were right, you're supposed to wear a mask? It's all grift. He has to ride it to the grave.
They all do it. And it is. And Bill Mitchell is one of those people, there's some on the left too, when it comes to Bernie Sanders, where they're like, oh, I'm going to open it up just in case the person I've latched my apple wagon to falls out of favor, I can say told you so afterwards. And Bill Mitchell is he's going to stay with Trump till the last possible day. But there might be a time when Trump loses embarrassingly. And is Bill Mitchell going to point out all the actual reasons Trump lost and then analyze them earnestly? No, he's going to say Trump lost because he wasn't strong enough on masks. And I'm the only person who was strong enough on masks.
Yeah.
But the grift is just all about finding that dominant strategy of an idiot and a moron. And that is, maybe Trump after that point will be hiring people for his new news program so they can go hard in the face of reason and actual reporting. And he'll try to get involved with that. But but I do think that I agree with you. I put on a mask and literally within seconds I'm struggling to breathe is – a version of that is every tweet that Bill Mitchell has ever tweeted.
Yeah.
It's stupid and ridiculous.
Yeah, I love what you said. The metaphor, really, the grift is just find a ridiculous fake mountain to stand on and say, I'm better for this reason. I'm smarter, more clued in, whatever. Now come around me and let's point at all the people that don't hold this insane, ridiculous, ever-changing radical position effectively. And he's done that. And what I worry is, again, I don't want to focus too much on just tweets, but there was a response to his tweet that gave me hope at first, and then I kept reading that said, because he said, you know, masks are not necessary, effectively. Water droplet-containing pathogens transmitting infection over aerosols can be significantly reduced by masks. Sounds good so far, right? Goes on to say, yet I believe COVID is mainly a political stunt. The virus is within humans since ages, like influenza is. It's just now they started measuring.
What? No, that's not true at all. That's not even remotely true.
That's not true.
Nope. But like that first part does explain why masks are good. The downside is you protecting other people, and no one on the right wants to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and the people who are like, well, you know, the size of the virus is like this, and the size of the holes in the mask is like this, as if the virus is crawling through the hole itself rather than being expelled in water droplets that are far larger. It's just so frustrating day after day. Like, as much as this quarantine is destroying me, knowing that it's going to continue because we can't get through to these morons and get them to do something as simple as put on a mask. You might recall two Fridays ago, we did an edition of Garbage People where Brett Ehrlich presented his.
My favorite person, I'm so happy you haven't done it yet, is Deborah Baber.
Oh, no.
Deborah Baber, a.k.a. Ventura County Karen. For those of you not familiar, I am of Ventura County. And Deborah Baber went to the Board of Supervisors meeting in Ventura so that she could protest this evil use of masks.
So it was great suggestion for garbage people. But the thing is, Deborah Baber did not go, you know, quietly into that whatever that night or whatever. Now she's back. She's back, Brett. She's heard your hate. And now she's responding.
I have received ugly, foul, threatening remarks ever since. Vile.
Vile.
Well, these fools, they also did the same thing. Why did they do this? They did this because they don't have any facts. They have to attack me personally. They have to threaten me personally. They have to threaten my family personally because they've got nothing. Nada. Zero. They can't attack the message. What was my message? My message was this. It is not normal for people to cover their faces. It is an act of submission, subjugation, of slavery, of shame. Only women in Islamic countries cover their faces with burqas. The men do not. Antifa thugs cover their faces. Patriots do not.
Don't put on a mask because you'll become Antifa. Brett, so she's back.
Wait. I'm starting to forget some of the stupidity in what she said. Oh my God. The main part about slavery was the mask wearing. That was the main problem with slavery. If everything else held true in slavery, it would have been fine. It was the mask wearing. No patriot has ever worn a mask. No New England patriot has ever worn a face mask. No patriot going into an area that has, I don't know, I don't vaguely remember the sacrifices of the Greatest Generation, but I believe there was mustard gas against which they wore masks.
Yeah.
Like, what are we? What are you talking about? And the thing is, like, that you pointed out, the line reads,
These fools.
So if you read just the copy of her statement, it seems like she's not loving every minute of it. But there's something about her delivery that makes me think that Debbie Debs is in pig hog heaven, loving every single portion of every single eyeball that is directed her way. She just relishes every little tiny bit of it. And she did as she was making her triptych of all the ways she is not into S&M, which I'm not convinced of yet.
She does love it. She talked in the extended remarks about how many views her little viral video got. And there's two reasons why I want to cover this. One is because I knew you'd enjoy it. Two, because let's make her a congresswoman. You know what? Next Republican congresswoman from Ventura could end up being this woman, because why not? She thinks masks are the same as everything insane you've ever thought of, and that's all it takes at this point, as she makes clear in the next section of the video.
Guidance on face covering is all over the map. Maybe a face covering, maybe not a face covering. Yes, a face covering, no, a face covering. CDC, well, this is my face covering. No to masks. In this pandemic, the only thing about masks is that one size does not fit all. There is no excuse for the behavior of you or the inaction. Stop this ridiculous charade. Don't remain the weak-kneed, indulgent parents that you are right now, trying to force grown-ups to play peekaboo. Shame on you.
Okay, so she's got the Trump face thing, which actually would block the sneezes, so that's good. So she presents it as, it's mixed information. Yes, a face covering. No, a face covering. Okay, so early on, there was a Dr. Fauci video from like 3 months ago where he briefly said you didn't need to do it or whatever. And they now say it's to preserve PPE for the doctors. Everyone is saying that knows what they're talking about is saying yes. Occasionally, a psycho says no. That is not mixed information about face coverings. She's a bit off there.
The scientists, the experts, everyone who's ever gone to school for this is saying yes, but this plate of pizza is silent on the matter. Mixed information. Like, that's it. Like, I asked this Olaf stuffed animal, what is the answer? And it hasn't said you have to wear a mask, so who knows? Mm-hmm. And this was my favorite character in Frozen. And I'm surprised I didn't say the word charade instead of charade there.
Yeah.
I was just like, she's absolutely going to say charade. But I was wrong. I apologize, Deb.
I would have. And finally, on the end, she said, "Let's not be the like something like permissive parents." No, but that's what the Republican governors who are not restarting lockdowns, who are not forcing mask wearing, are doing. They're being permissive. They're like, well, you know, the kids are acting up. What are you going to do? Like DeSantis literally said, we can't make young people abide by social distancing, so why try? They're being permissive. You guys are having your temper tantrums, and they're like, okay, fine, spread a fatal disease. That's the most permissive parenting I can imagine, and you're advocating for it.
You said we should make her a congressperson. Do you know who was running to be her congressperson?
It was Cenk, right? Uger.
Yeah, she's a Simi kid, just like me.
Yeah.
Growing up with these people.
Yeah.
Imagine Simi Valley. Where she's from. Do you know where she's from?
Where?
She's from the city that not only was where they shot Little House on the Prairie, mm-hmm. but it was the city where they decided they were going to move the Rodney King trial because they wanted a non-biased group of jurors. That place is also home to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library.
Wow.
And pretty much every retired cop from LA County.
So you're saying maybe biased.
Maybe a little biased. Maybe a little biased. But just a picture. But okay. We did get a Togo's and a Jamba when I was like 16. Hmm. So we're with the future.
Not bad. Not bad. Still have a bit of hope that hypothetically we might begin to take this pandemic seriously. Remember the pandemic that we're in that people pretend it doesn't exist anymore? And one thing that gives me a bit of hope is that the biggest detractors this entire time has been the right wing. Regular people, but mainly they're doing that because right-wing media and right-wing politicians have told them to. But the changing nature of the pandemic gives me reason to believe that this is going to become a little bit harder to deny. And this chart I want to show you really makes clear the cases per day broken down by whether they're occurring in states won by Trump in 2016 or states won by Clinton in 2016. And you can see that early on, the first part of the first wave, or wave 1A as I call it, was predominantly blue, especially New York and New Jersey and that area. But as time is passing, you're seeing that the red states are climbing very fast, and wave 1B, which we're currently in the beginning of, is a much more bipartisan pandemic. Now, that does not mean that they're definitely going to take it seriously this time. But more of the deaths that hypothetically are coming will be occurring in red states. And so maybe they'll take it seriously. Maybe we can come together to fight this thing, especially as we get closer to the general election. Brett, what do you think?
I think it's great that the Republicans are finally getting off their ass and catching up to the rest of us. I thought that we could keep them down, but it turns out we can't keep them down. They, against all odds, will have places with fewer people, yet way, 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 way more infections.
Mm-hmm.
So good for them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems like when I look at this chart, it seems so obvious that of course the first part of the first wave is going to hit the coastal areas where people are flying in, and especially if at that point we're not doing any testing, it's going to spread, you know, uncontrollably for a few weeks. But then, like, the fact that the controls that we put in effect largely around the country, and understandably so that it wouldn't spread, eventually taps out, like, the population taps out on their willingness to accept it. And if that happens in some states like Texas and Arizona, Oklahoma, before we're done with this thing, then yeah, it's going to continue to spread. It's going to hit areas that haven't already suffered. It's going to catch up. And some of these states, I don't understand why, especially if it's hitting in Florida and Texas and Arizona. These are all states that, even if not for moral or public health reasons, for purely political reasons, why wouldn't you take this more seriously in an election year that you're going to let it rampage through Florida and Texas, which is looking really tight? I don't understand why, just for cynical, pragmatic reasons, they're not taking it more seriously.
Because of identity politics.
Yeah.
That's it. They need an identity that is distinct. I mean, this isn't exactly identity politics, but it's related to the shift toward identity politics. But they need something that sets them apart. And they think, and by now the dumb, stupid, brainless tail is wagging the dog. So they think they have this idea of who their supporters are, and they're gearing everything toward that same, to this one clump of stupid anti-intellectual instincts. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, what are experts doing? We hate them, those elitist pigs. We're better than them. So let's just act this other way. And what you said makes absolute total sense. Like, it would go to places where the planes land. Then it's possible that if those states messed up, those states would continue this same crazy trend. Mm-hmm. And then this should give the red states every single opportunity to put in the very precautions or the very measures to prevent this that the coastal cities befell, because they were taken by surprise. You have no excuse anymore. You were taken by surprise. How do I know? You're on record complaining about all this stuff ahead of time and dismissing it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You know everything about it, and you had every opportunity to get ready for it, and you didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I think one really important thing to see is, as states like Arizona and Texas, and to a lesser extent Florida, start to put into effect limited controls, which we've seen over the past week, how is that going to be taken by the conservatives in the state who are already complaining in Texas? And what will Trump do? Because originally, I think it might have been Georgia. You remember there was like, he wanted to open up, and Trump apparently like reassured him on the phone that he supported him, but then he attacked him publicly, but then he reversed his attack. Mm-hmm. They couldn't seem to figure out, how are we supposed to treat Republican governors that disagree with Trump on this? I wonder if Texas locks down, if Florida locks down to save their own people, will Trump at least hold off on the criticism to help them politically, to not make a big issue of it? Or is he going to react in a knee-jerk way and undercut their efforts to stop the spread of the virus?
I don't know, but I don't know. And I hope that, because his only instincts are to divide and conquer, right? So he will continue to divide people. That's not a question. And the question is only, how much will he divide his own damn base, his own damn people? Like, is he going to burn it down just so he can rule the ashes?
Yeah, maybe. A little bit of good news coming out of the South, even if just symbolic, it's something that has been pushed for a long time. Mississippi flag is a-changing, with Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves signing a bill yesterday abandoning the state's flag and stripping the Confederate battle flag symbol from it. With Reeves' move, Mississippi will take down one of the country's most prominent Confederate tributes, withdrawing the only state flag that still bears such an emblem. The new flag's design will be determined later, but lawmakers have barred it from including the most recognizable icon of the Confederacy. You would assume, if you're taking it down for having that symbol, you wouldn't replace it with, you know, an even bigger version of it. But the governor had this to say, "This is not a political moment to me, but a solemn occasion to lead our Mississippi family to come together and move on. A flag is a symbol of our past, our present, and our future. For those reasons, we need a new symbol." And apparently, at least for the last few years, Reeves has supported changing the flag. I bring this up for you mainly because this is something that you've talked about a few times on the show in the past.
I don't believe that Mississippi will have... I don't believe that this is actually real, simply because I don't believe that Tate Reeves is an actual name. I think it was auto-generated from an AI that was fed Confederacy imagery forever and just spat out, "Tate Reeves! He owns a plantation outside Biloxi." So that's one thing. Second, I don't know if you know about other flags that everyone's like, "Well, this is the only one with Confederate imagery on it." No, it's not. Arkansas's fourth star is the Confederacy on its flag. Georgia's flag story is absolutely amazing. Georgia's flag story is amazing. Georgia has this flag that from up until 2001, everyone's like, it was a giant battle flag of the Confederacy. And everyone's like, "We got to protect this because it's as old as Georgia itself." No, it's not. That was put in place in 1956 by
it's a weird time
person named Jefferson Lee Davis.
Hmm.
And so it was 1956 up until about 2001, where these kinds of considerations were again coming up for review. And just so you know, that Georgia had a Democratic governor after the Civil War up until 2003 because of these exact – because they didn't like that Republican Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. So as an act of defiance, they were Democrats the whole way through. And the only reason – that they switched back to Republicans as a final symbol that that party realignment had absolutely happened, because Georgia is like the symbol of the old South dying. Just ask Harper Lee. Like, that's why there's a dog that gets shot in To Kill a Mockingbird, because Georgia's the last remnant of the old South. Like, they got rid of that flag and finally went to the Republican. They finally went to the Republican governorship because they changed the flag. Now, how did they change the flag? They went from the giant one they didn't get rid of, but they diminished the size of the battle flag on their flag to make it a little one of the five flags on the bottom to symbolize what? All of the previous flags of Georgia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did we just hear from fictional Tate Reeves? It symbolizes our past, our present, and our future. This just smacks of the same exact stuff that happened in Georgia, where everyone is going to, they're probably going to try to find some way to keep the Confederacy in there, which maybe that's a win. Maybe that's a win, because right now, what are we experiencing? We're experiencing this rebirth of all of this, instead of implicit racism, this explicit racism in the South. Like, it is getting more vocal. And we need to make sure that it doesn't just go to this unspoken thing. Now, how unspoken? I think it was Sonny Perdue, who I think that is the Sonny Perdue's dad. Sonny Perdue comes in as the governor of Georgia, and they get a new, I think it's Sonny Perdue, A. Perdue, becomes governor of Georgia, and they put together a new flag. And I've seen you kind of opening it up.
That you're talking about Georgia?
Georgia. So in Georgia, let's show if you can bring it in and show the flag.
I'm trying. Okay.
You're getting it. You got it.
You want this?
Okay, so yeah.
Okay, there you go.
So that's the flag of Georgia. It's okay, you get an idea. That flag of Georgia is, if you take away the little insignia in the center of that circle, the flag of Georgia now is just the Confederate national flag.
Yeah.
It is just the stars and bars.
Yeah.
It is. So what they did is they got rid of, and I'm sorry that this is like so nerdy and so inside, you know, bannerism, but like, what's the word?
There's this
word.
Fun with flags with this Sheldon fun Cooper. With flags.
But that's it. But there was such a negative reaction to not eliminating, but reducing the size of the Confederate battle flag on Georgia's flag, that they replaced it with the actual national flag of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
And so when they say that they're going to do this in Mississippi, I don't buy it for a second. Hopefully they'll replace it with a flag that's just a magnolia tree and a guitar.
Exactly. Or like put some food on there or something. I don't know. Do something. But we'll see.
But like fried green tomatoes, you know, the guitar because it's the birthplace of the Delta Blues, and a magnolia tree because who could get mad at magnolia trees?
Mm-hmm. You would think. But for now, all we know is it can't have the Confederate symbol and it has to have In God We Trust. Another battle for the future, I guess. Jesus, does it have to be on there? Isn't he always in your heart? Like, does he have to be on there too? I don't know. Seems weird with the whole church state thing. Donald Trump has been criticized over the past few days during this entire Afghanistan Russia bounties thing for apparently not paying attention to his intelligence briefings, not reading them and all of that, and that seems like trouble, since the president hypothetically should know about these sorts of things, whether they turn out to be true or not. He sort of has to be exposed to this information. And so he's been receiving a lot of criticism for that. And his spokeswoman, Kayleigh McEnany, assures us that not only does he know what's going on, but he knows it better than literally anyone in the world.
I would re-ask the question of whether it was in his material, but asking maybe to defend why the president isn't necessarily reading his PDB when there are these types of issues that could arise.
The president does read, and he also consumes intelligence verbally. This president, I'll tell you, is the most informed person on planet Earth when it comes to the threats that we face. You have Ambassador O'Brien, who sees him in person twice a day, who sometimes takes the upwards of half a dozen calls with this president. He's constantly being informed and briefed on intelligence matters.
That's the first time I've ever heard the term upwards of half a dozen. Five?
Yeah, upwards is supposed to be for like 50, 20. Upwards of 20, not upwards of three. So look, there's two different things there. One is the reading and the other is how else he learns it. And she assures us he's tops on both. The issue is your whole defense in this, whether you think that this is a real story or not a real story, your whole defense was he didn't read it. So he didn't know, because we don't want you to think he knew, so he couldn't have read it. So then for you to say, no, he reads everything, he reads more than everyone, that's BS. The other thing is, okay, so he doesn't read, but he talks to a lot of people. He's exposed to their expertise. He goes on calls with experts and all of that. The issue is, we already know that that's not true either. And so I want to quickly run you through a little bit of what upwards of 11 of his former officials have said about him in these intelligence briefings. By the way, it means 10, because that's how that works. So, President Donald Trump often struggles to focus during his intelligence briefings and frequently ignores information he disagrees with. That's according to the New York Times not long ago. And these are all from people who've been in the briefings with him. So remember, back when it came to what he knew and when he knew it about coronavirus, he blamed the January 23rd intelligence briefing for not adequately warning him of the threat the virus posed, even though he was also warned by a bevy of other sources, including epidemiologists, national security officials, biodefense officials, and his own health secretary. So shades of the situation we're in right now. It was in his briefing, which he didn't read, but hypothetically he met with all these other people, but he apparently didn't listen to them either. And so whether it's foreign policy or it's a national health crisis, it can't get through to him no matter what. But just a bit more, officials told the Times that Trump doesn't read the written intelligence reports he's given, though he does look at visuals such as graphs, charts, tables, and satellite images. I doubt the tables, personally. It's not really that much of an image. Instead, he prefers to receive information from conservative media and friends. But the issue is that conservative media and friends don't have access to our dozen plus intelligence agencies. They are not sources for new information. They're sources for reassuring narratives and misinformation at best.
This proves what he thinks the job of president is. And it is not to protect the country. It is not to work in the best interests of Americans. It is to control a narrative. And it is to get reelected. It is to be the popularist kid in school. It is to make a bunch of people feel like they're the coolest, but it has nothing to do with the actual best interests of the United States. And it's proven when he does that. Mm-hmm. And it disproves what Kayleigh McEnany says. Yes, he's in a position to be the most informed person in the world. 100%. There, yeah. By definition, he won't be the most informed person in the world because the people giving him the intelligence have read more and are giving him a smaller amount of it than they have access to. So no, but he is supposed to be that. The only thing between him and being the most informed person in the world on these matters is his willingness to do it. And I would argue his capacity to really understand the responsibility. He can't. Yeah. He's unable. He is inept.
Yeah, the idea that no, just trust us, he pays attention at all, he's super informed, like this bounty thing, like we're a couple of days off, as someone in the comments pointed out, the villages thing where he's retweeting videos that he apparently isn't watching because he didn't hear one of the first things. But then when she's asked, well, so is he retweeting things without watching him, she says no, he watches it. Like, you can't have as your defense he wasn't aware of this and then say, oh no, he totally watched the entire thing, but somehow didn't hear someone yelling white power when it's one of the first things in the video. Like, they want to have their idiocy and eat it too.
And they eat it. They consume their idiocy verbally, orally. Mm-hmm. As my wife put it, I want to make sure that I have the exact quote from her tweet, from her chat. She butt chugs intelligence briefings daily. Like, that's what it sounds like. It's like he consumes his intelligence verbally. No, he just is a. He doesn't. And everyone knows that McCabe was on CNN. I don't know if it was today or yesterday, but he basically said the thing that you know, that all of us know, everyone's pretending like they have all the machinations making, isn't making it up. She absolutely is making it up because we all know. Shut your eyes, get in touch with your feelings. You know it to be true. Like this dude, that McCabe says we have to bring pictures. We have to bring video.
Yeah.
That's it. And yeah. That's true. We know that it's true. We know he doesn't do anything besides that. No one pictures Donald Trump saying, excuse me, please step aside so I can read my intelligence briefing. Mm-hmm. There is no way in hell.
Yeah. It's like we were saying a couple years ago. It's like when Tyrion tried to make Joffrey a little bit better of a potential king, a little bit more responsible, try to train him. It's mm-hmm. impossible. No matter what, you can try whatever technique you have. Like, writing or meeting with people, it doesn't matter. He's got stupidity and ignorance to match both. He said in January 2017, I like bullets, or I like as little as possible. I don't need, 200-page reports. I just put it on a page that I can tell you. So he doesn't like it written down. But when you just try to tell him about it, oral intelligence briefings also frequently go awry. As Trump veers off topic, expresses skepticism, pivots to gossip he heard from his friends, or just stops listening if he's told he is incorrect. He's there to be told things he doesn't know about, and when he tries to say, no, that's not true, even though he doesn't know anything about it, if you point out, no, well, this is actually the information we gathered that you don't have access to, we have thousands of people whose sole job is to gather this information, so we just want to present it to you, he just stops listening. What a joke of a government we have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All lives don't matter to Trump. He doesn't care.
He does not care. Not long ago, news leaked that Donald Trump sees one potential way to sort of instill a little bit of confidence in his base, get them a little bit fired up and ready to go. And that was that he's been talking more and more in private about how he's just hot for a Supreme Court seat to open up. And a lot of people, including myself, took those initial reports to mean, oh, he's just waiting for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to die, which seems sort of morbid. But apparently that might not have been the entirety of what he was talking about, because new reports are saying that he is actually expecting potentially, and might have information leading into this, that Clarence Thomas might retire before the 2020 election, opening up a last-minute Supreme Court seat that he could either fill really fast or use to inspire conservative turnout. Now, I have not heard anything from Clarence Thomas implying this. All of this appears to be private and might be baseless. But Brett Ehrlich, if Clarence Thomas, uber conservative, does step down, would that help him win re-election?
There is, well, no, because the Democrats won't confirm. I don't know. Is it a 50?
Are you sure that they would not?
I don't think it matters. I think they go nuclear. I think this is their last best hope. So there's that. There is no way you could find a more conservative justice than Clarence Thomas. Mm-hmm. And how would you know from Clarence Thomas what he's thinking? He never speaks.
That's true.
Like, he is the silentest of the people on the Supreme Court, famous for never really asking a question, for just sitting there and going, I already know what I want to say. I already know what I'm going to write. The only time he opens his mouth is to sexually harass people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're right. It might be based on nothing. It might just be, a semi-silent wish, a prayer for the future. But potentially, like...
God, I hope he retires.
So, yeah. I think that it's likely that... It's not just that hypothetically the Democrats could try to block it. I don't even know that they would because, Democrats. But you need a certain amount of time to, put someone forward, go through the hearings. The idea that you would push that through in a week, I mean, I guess Mitch McConnell's the person that would do it, if anyone would. Maybe they would. Holding it out to inspire Republicans.
Wouldn't let it happen.
Who wouldn't?
Mitch. Wouldn't let it happen.
Wouldn't let what happen?
Wouldn't let Trump. Wouldn't let Clarence Thomas retire.
You're saying he would stop him.
Yeah. Why would he allow that to happen? It is.
Does he have control over it?
He would do everything in his power to stop that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you introduce uncertainty at all?
Well, the idea is that hypothetically, if in some states, especially conservative, you know, like we're talking Georgia, we're talking Texas, if you want them to turn out and if they're kind of just sick of Trump and they're not interested anymore, losing the most reliable conservative vote in the Supreme Court, potentially on the eve of Joe Biden getting control of the court, is one way to get them to turn out.
Right, but the smartest thing to do is to have Clarence Thomas retire after. Like, what you have is a certain thing versus an uncertain thing. The uncertain thing is that this would make any difference in an election where in every other situation and every other circumstance, Donald Trump bungles his chances of winning. And you would then introduce an uncertain thing, which is finding someone who would replace him that's more conservative. Maybe you could do that. But a uncertain thing is way worse than a certain thing. No, the certain thing for McConnell to do is to see if Trump wins and then get Clarence Thomas to retire.
You're saying like during, before, like
in the meantime,
Biden wins, but before Biden gets inaugurated, you're saying do it then?
What am I going to trust Donald Trump to replace to have the right, mm-hmm. to put the right person in place there? Well, what he did is Gorsuch has been a tie-breaking vote on important Supreme Court decisions since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but hypothetically,
oh my God, that's so stupid.
In the past, I have seen that Trump does seem to have less personal preference for these judges and might be willing to talk with Mitch McConnell. Anyway, if you're talking about an uncertainty versus a certainty, the uncertainty is that Trump wins. So do
right, you, which
why
is
do you want Biden to choose a justice then?
Because even if things are so bad right now, John, that even with this extra and so unproven motivator mm-hmm. in this situation, because previously it was a lost cause anyway. McConnell's play was like, all right, fine. Worst case scenario, you know, it's what was going to happen. Merrick Garland happens with someone with a different name, right? In this situation, it's, we have Clarence Thomas, mm-hmm. and worst case scenario is we've just created a vacancy for a Democrat to fill. That is so paralyzingly stupid from a strategic perspective that only a Democrat could get behind it.
Mm-hmm. What I am saying is that potentially they fill it. That's what I'm saying, hypothetically. Anyway, it might end up not coming true at all. Again, he has not said anything publicly about retiring. I'm just saying it is something that he is considering as something that could boost him, whether we agree or not that it actually could.
This is never going to happen. Mitch McConnell's never going to let it happen. They would poison Ginsburg before they do this.
Okay. Let's not put that out there.
We still don't know who Joe Biden is going to pick to be his running mate, but since the beginning, before Joe Biden was even the presumptive nominee, one of the names going around was Stacey Abrams. And joining us now to break down one of the big things that has made Stacey Abrams a little bit different than a lot of the other names being considered is former White House Senior Director Nyjer Haq. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Always great to be with you, John.
Glad to have you here. And so this isn't specifically necessarily about her politics, which we can get into, but you wrote an article about one of the things that sort of stylistically or in terms of approach and personality that made Stacey Abrams a little bit different than how potential VPs have acted in the past. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So listen, Joe Biden has already made a commitment that whoever is his nominee for vice president, we're going to be calling her Madam VP. So I think that's already a sign of progress. But there is something about when women ask for power, people don't like it. And this is not just me pulling this out of thin air. This is the subject of Harvard studies and multiple studies that show that people like when women are achieving in a job and they're doing well. But when women express ambition, that they want more, right? Like a woman runs for president, for example. example, the criticisms start to come out and there's just a bit of distaste. And when Stacey Abrams, which I think very audaciously, decided to say, I want to be VP and here's what I bring to the table, there was a slew of negative articles written about her, like almost to the point of like, how dare she? You don't do that. We don't ask for that. You're supposed to pretend that you don't want the job, and then suddenly somebody, you know, handpicks you and says, you've got the gig now, and you're supposed to be grateful for it. So the idea of Stacey Abrams just boldly asking for the gig, making a case, and on top of that, being a black woman who is not petite, I think is very, not only audacious, but is a lesson for all of the other women, particularly minority women, women of color, who realize that unless we ask for what we're not, what we want, no one's gonna hand it to us.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe this isn't the same thing, but let me know if you think this might be attached. Like you ask someone, are you going to run for president? And they lie and lie and lie up until they announce that they're going to. There's this refusal to be honest about things that hypothetically don't seem that weird to point out. Do you think that something fundamental might be changing? Like when Stacey Abrams is like, no, I want to be VP, obviously. And you, as you point out, she gets criticized. Are we moving into a phase where maybe hypothetically you won't be criticized as much or at all if you just are clear about your ambitions?
Yeah, I think men have been allowed to do that, and particularly white men of a certain generation, because they have the legacy connections, right, to get them into whatever the C-suite job is, or they have the legacy connections to get them into Harvard or the elite schools, right? If for people, minority men and women, not opening your mouth, not pushing for it, not asking for it, and you just kind of like play the shy game, you're not gonna get the job anyway, right? So I think it's a system and a culture that is skewed particularly towards helping white men advance who can afford to be humble. And even some studies have shown that the, you know, one of the better leadership values is humility. But when you overlay that with gender, the humility actually cuts against women because people who are interviewing you or looking to make the decision think that, oh, well, you didn't actually do anything. Yeah. Right? You're not boasting about yourself, so you didn't actually do anything versus, oh, look at this person who's so accomplished and they're so humble about it. So the gender dynamics of ambition, I think, are fascinating, and we definitely see them come to play when it comes to election cycles and political events.
Now, I remember you made a point in the article that was something to the effect of women, best case scenario, have to run on the experiences they already have, whereas men get to present themselves as having potential. Like, yeah, maybe I haven't done this stuff, but hypothetically I could do a lot. I'm assuming you think that might be particularly a strong effect in politics.
Oh, absolutely, right? So you look at Barack Obama and Mitt Romney when they were running against each other. Barack Obama and Mitt. When you look at Barack Obama, when he was first running, he claimed that he had all sorts of abilities to negotiate and discuss foreign policy, but he had never done anything related to foreign policy before, right? Mm-hmm. And so him going to Berlin was a big deal to show, oh, look, he can communicate with the rest of the world. Mitt Romney then, when he ran, same thing, he's running for commander in chief. Zero foreign policy experience. Stacey Abrams, member of Council of Foreign Relations, member of all different think tanks. She's, you know, public policy, she studied in school. One of the things people criticize her for, she has no foreign policy experience. And I look at that and think, again, the men who are running for positions of greater power with less experience are allowed to get away with the potential, whereas she, as a woman, and other women, if they don't have the experience, is automatically considered a negative.
You know, I want to talk a bit more about Stacey Abrams. I'm curious about your read as you've been watching this whole thing develop. There's a lot of names that have been talked about as potential considerations, and Biden, as of yesterday, was saying there's whole categories of people that you have not even thought about that I'm considering. Do you think that Stacey Abrams' chances have, at least in terms of public perception, gone down since the beginning of this process, or do you still think that she's a strong contender for it?
Here's what I know. Everyone's talking about her in a way that they may not have been before. And to some degree, in, especially in politics, when it's about name recognition, she's gotten also great reviews that go along with the negative reviews. She has a great book that's out that's getting all sorts of attention because of her, the conversation about her potentially being a VP nominee. So either way, even if she doesn't get that job, she has raised her profile in a way that will help her advance whatever she wants to do politically. And so I think that's the lesson also to take from this, is that ambition may not be met in that specific space, but it does get you a level of attention that you otherwise would not have had.
Okay, that's true. And you know, in terms of the politics, I'm interested in your watching Stacey Abrams. I know that obviously, like, she, fair to say, rose to sort of national stature, where people talking about her nationally about 2 years ago or so, for a combination of her run, but also her work in fighting voter suppression. And I know, you know, like watching, like in progressive circles, their evaluation of her has changed a lot over the past year or so, with her work with Bloomberg and some of her statements that seem less outwardly progressive than how she initially presented herself in 2018. And I know that some stuff has been constant throughout her fighting against voter suppression and all of that. But what do you think about that? Do you think that the initial perception might have been a little bit off, or how do you see that?
I think especially in the last couple of weeks, when we're dealing with issues related to systemic racism and racism in homes and in our communities and people wrestling with that, Stacey Abrams has a really strong case that she's making about her ability to turn out African-American and Latino voters, which she did in Georgia in record numbers. So she has that ability to turn out voters on the grassroots level. But, you know, she didn't run a national campaign for president compared to Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, right? Both of those women have also served in the Senate. So her experience is different than what other women bring to the table. You know, Val Demings, kind of a congresswoman, she was a rock star when it came to the impeachment. So there, I think, so many different considerations here, and whether or not somebody is going to balance off Biden on being on the progressive left, which I would personally like to see, is not even something that's been guaranteed by the campaign. So all we know right now is the campaign itself wants a woman. I hope that it is a diverse woman who brings a lens to the table that not only reflects the issues of minorities, but the issues of working class Americans and the issues that progressives really care about around the country.
If it was up to you, who would you pick?
I don't know. And so this is like one of
that's,
those.
That's like, honest. Look, right? Honesty.
Like week to week, I'm like, I want it to be somebody who is progressive. And to be honest, anybody on this spectrum is better than what the spectrum is of Mike Pence and Donald Trump. And I love the idea of the commitment being made that it's a woman. I think any of the women whose names we've heard, they're very smart women. So smart women, empathetic Joe Biden, I think just makes a great ticket for right now.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, I want to transition to another recent article of yours. A lot of attention has been paid while the protests have developed over the course of the past few months that, hey, look, they are far more diverse than these sorts of protests might have been in years past. That, look, white individuals are showing up and standing alongside, protesting against police brutality and all of that. But how much does it actually mean to go to a protest? How significant is that? Nayira, you wrote an article, "If You're Not Black in America, Protesting is the Easy Part." Tell us a little bit about what you're getting at.
Yeah, so I wrote that for the Washington Post after a long reflection on really how my life has operated. I have a black husband, I have a black son. So a lot of this affects us in a very personal and deep way, but I'm very aware of the fact that I'm not black. And so there are things that are easier for me to do and things that are easier for you, John, to do in society that just, it doesn't bring the risk of police brutality, of being separated from your family, or even, you know, day-to-day job discrimination, housing discrimination, that blackness does. And so I think that that's part of the recognition of, is while it's great to have this huge coalition that is still turning out in the streets and putting the pressure on, that we, the rest of us who are not black, have to practice anti-racism on a day-to-day level, right? This is, there are the people who are the activists and the policymakers who are coming together and using all of this grassroots pressure to push for legislation at the federal level, to push for legislation at the state level, But at the end of the day, if we're not changing the culture in our communities and the culture of where our police officers are raised, we're not going to end up solving this problem. And that's, frankly, that's on the rest of us.
Yeah, and I found it interesting you talk about the difference between sort of going to a protest, being anti-racist in public, where it can be seen, where hypothetically you could post about it on social media, versus doing it persistently, consistently in private. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think the second part in private, right, where it's your friends and your family and everybody looks like you, that it feels it's riskier. I mean, I think it takes a level of social courage to challenge somebody, whether it be your uncle or grandpa or even a friend, for making a racist comment, saying like, dude, that was kind of racist. Like, what's up with that? It's much harder to do that because you risk losing social capital. Whereas if, particularly if you're in progressive circles, right, going out and protesting as a group, there's an affirmation that comes with it, right? Like, it feels good to be speaking up and doing something and being out in the streets. And so there's a social affirmation that comes with being able to do that. Now, of course, there are risks with, we've seen how police react, we've seen how the White House has reacted, but even then you're with a cohort of people who will back you up. It's when you're alone, yeah, right? When you're alone and you're not the dominant voice, that I think it takes a lot more courage to speak up. But I also think it's where it's necessary to speak up, because we hide so much behind this idea of civility, right? I'm just gonna let it go, I'm gonna play nice, let's just move on from that. And that civility actually ends up being a cover for the person who is deeply racist to keep mouthing off, and we cede the floor to them. So like, I end up being polite, and they end up dominating the space. And you look at them like, that's actually not the outcome we're looking for when we talk about what civility should be.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting, because I think when I think about like it being in LA, when you go to a protest, you know, you go to one of these protests, who are you in opposition to? Hypothetically, the cops, but also conservatives who are, yeah, exactly, or conservatives who are sort of explicitly want to maintain this system. That's not, like, as you point out, yes, there are potential costs, but it's not super difficult for a sort of LA white liberal to do that. Doing it in private, who are you in opposition to? Probably not a super conservative. It's probably another liberal who, despite not being a conservative, still benefits from white privilege if they're white, probably holds some, you know, problematic views. And it's sometimes more difficult to provide that sort of criticism to people that are closer to us politically than those who are much farther, where, yeah, there's a bigger gap, but that gap sort of insulates you from any sort of pain or cost to it.
Right, and that gap also comes in, right? Still trying to chip away this idea that I'm not racist, all right? I'm not part of the KKK. I believe black people should be able to vote, and you know, I would never like beat somebody up for being black. And like, that seems to be the threshold of not being racist. Like, I'm like, no, guys, that was 60 years ago. Right, right now we're trying to make sure that there's equity and that people have equal chances, and we have to look at the systems that we've created and that we actively participate in. I mean, for example, the South Asian community deeply benefited from the civil rights movement, because that at the same time is when Congress then pushed through immigration reform that allowed for all of these folks to be able to come in from overseas, particularly the doctors and nurses and engineers that we have from South Asia. Direct result of the civil rights movement, yet it is not a community that has recognized or allied itself with black people for, you know, generations. And so that's part of the unraveling of what are the kinds of prejudices we're bringing to the table when we have these conversations, and thinking that we're allying ourselves with what is white supremacy rather than allying ourselves with the people who are in the same position as us, who are advocating for the same things that we want, which is equity in society.
Yeah. Well, look, I want to thank you for both writing it, but also joining us. Very interesting conversation. Definitely raises a lot of thoughts, worthy of a bit of introspection. And so, Nayar Haq, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.